Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today we begin a series on objections to belief in God. We start with part one. For many more resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Well, I can't tell you how delighted Jan and I are to be back. And I don't just say that. I really mean it. We really miss this class when we're away. And I was in Chicago yesterday speaking at a fabulous apologetics conference at Moody Church, but I insisted on leaving early in the afternoon from the conference just so I could get back here in time for this Sunday school class this morning, because I we want to be with you. And for us, that's the real priority. And we've come now to the end of the 40 Days of Purpose campaign, and so we're ready to get back onto our regular curriculum. And I don't know about you, but I'm excited to do that, to get back to Christian doctrine and apologetics. So that's what we're going to start doing again. Okay, well, I wanted to just share a little bit with you about what I was doing yesterday at Moody, and then about this trip to Hong Kong that Jan and I have just returned from. Normally, I don't do speaking at Christian conferences. My ministry focuses on university evangelistic type speaking. But this conference they were having at Moody was so extraordinary that even though it's something I don't normally do, and even though it kind of came right on the heels of this exhausting trip overseas, I really wanted to do it. They were having a one-day apologetics conference at the historic Moody Church, the church founded originally by D.L. Moody in downtown Chicago. And they had, for the panel of speakers, Ravi Zacharias, and then myself, and then Philip Johnson, and then Erwin Lutzer, and then Emir Kaner, and then Frank Peretti, the novelist. I learned that Frank Peretti has written, or sold rather, over 12 million books, which really was a daunting statistic. But I also had another daunting task. I had to follow Ravi Zacharias on the program, which was really interesting. But they had well over 2,000 people come to this apologetics conference for one day of training in defending the faith. And I met folks during the book signing part of the conference from Michigan and Iowa and St. Louis. They'd come from just all around the Midwest as well as Chicago to be involved in this. And so many people, as I talked to them one-on-one, expressed how much in their personal lives reading a certain book or seeing a video had meant to them and strengthened them in their faith or saved them from losing their faith in some cases. And it was just confirmation again to me that there is going on in America right now a real grassroots revolution of interest in Christians becoming engaged with their minds, engaging their minds with their faith, and trying to understand reasons to believe and being able to articulate their faith in an intelligent way in the public square. And the thirst and the hunger out there that was evident in this conference is, for me, just very, very gratifying and exciting. So what we're doing here is just part of a much broader movement that's just happening all over the United States. Well, I wanted to share with you a little bit about Hong Kong and say, first of all, how much Jan and I appreciated the prayers and the support that you folks lent to us while we were there. It was an exhausting trip. They were determined to use me for all I was worth while I was there. And so sometimes I was speaking three or even four times a day, followed by long Q&A periods and then just talking one-on-one with students afterwards. And it was a really rich time, very differentiated in the kinds of outreaches they did. I spoke primarily in either churches to Christian groups, giving them training in apologetics, or else I spoke evangelistically at secular universities there. Now, with respect to the first type of speaking, I was preaching in three churches, the Kowloon International Baptist Church, the International Baptist Church, and then North Point Alliance Church. This latter church, the last one, North Point, was really interesting. It's a huge alliance Chinese church right down in the center of the city. And I spoke in the afternoon there on the problem of evil and suffering. How can God permit so much pain and suffering in the world? And it was completely packed. They had over 1,000 people in the main auditorium, and then an overflow room with another 500 people or so. And we had a tremendous time just interacting with people on a very personal level after I spoke on this whole problem of evil and suffering. So that was a very exciting meeting. I also had a chance to speak at a few seminaries. I spoke at the Chinese Graduate School of Theology, which is the largest seminary in Hong Kong. I talked to them on the quest of the historical Jesus. And then I also spoke at Alliance Biblical Seminary, which is a seminary that is on an island out in the bay of Hong Kong. It's on Chung Chau Island, which is a little island that can only be reached by ferry boat. And when you get there, there are no automobiles permitted on the island. You have to walk or bicycle everywhere you go. So we walked from the ferry dock up to the peak where Alliance Biblical Seminary was. And I also gave a talk on the historical Jesus to this group. And I think this talk was as much an encouragement to the faculty as to the students. It was really a kind of shot in the arm and an encouragement to these faculty to be engaged again and engaging their students in confronting the challenges that radical biblical criticism and things like the Da Vinci Code and so forth are posing to the church. And then there was one other seminary. Oh, yes, Hong Kong Baptist University has a divinity school at which I also spoke. I did a series of three apologetic evenings at Mong Kok Baptist Church. Mong Kok in Chinese means literally crowded corner. And Mong Kok is the most densely populated part of Hong Kong. When you go there, it is like wall to wall people just filling the sidewalks and the streets, and overhead are these bright neon lights with gigantic Chinese letters that stretch from one side of the street to the building on the other side almost. It's just an incredible scene at night to go down to Mong Kok. And the Mong Kok Baptist Church is not actually a church building. It's the ninth floor of one of these high-rises in Mong Kok that is the church. All over Hong Kong, you just see bristling these gigantic high-rise apartments, 40, 50 stories tall. And everything is built straight up because there's so little room. And so the church is on the ninth floor of one of these high-rise buildings. And these were very good meetings because they would have a sympathetic respondent at each one of these meetings, someone from a local divinity school or Hong Kong Baptist University who was also a Christian, but who would give some interaction with the apologetic lecture that I gave, and then I would get a final counter response to that person. And that kind of mixed it up a little bit, gave a more liveliness to the discussion. And these were very well attended and gave good training to these Christians in various areas of apologetics. But for me, the most exciting meetings were definitely the evangelistic meetings. Those are the ones that are on my heart and that I really went for. I spoke at five of the universities in Hong Kong. The first one was at the Polytechnic University. And that meeting was on a campus where there really isn't any Christian group to organize it. So it was the smallest of the meetings. We had about 30 kids come to that. But I spoke on the absurdity of life without God, and it really connected with the students. You could tell from the kind of questions they were asking that these were deep existential questions that they were facing. And what began to emerge right away that was interesting to me during the question time was the totally different cultural background from which these students were coming. Because the questions they were asking were things like, well, how does what you're saying relate to what Confucius says about this or that issue? Or, well, in the Buddhist perspective, we believe this or that, and how does that compare with what you're saying? And so the questions were very different in that sense from Western audiences, in that I was interacting with Buddhism and Taoism later Marxism when we went into the mainland. And so that was a really different angle on things. But just really rich questions. One of the questions that came up over and over again that kind of surprised me was the question, where did God come from? Because I would talk on the origin of the universe and so forth, and they'd say, well, where did God come from? Who made God? And I thought this was an odd question to have posed so often until we began to visit, and during some of our free time, some of these Buddhist and Taoist temples in Hong Kong. And these were really quite an experience, because I had always, my familiarity with Buddhism and Taoism was on a kind of very high philosophical level. But on a folk level, the folk religion is just gross polytheism. It's just crass polytheism. They go in these temples and shake and burn incense in front of these altars to these gods and goddesses. They believe there's a goddess of the sea that they worship. And they pray to these gods and goddesses, these spirits, for protection or for good fortune. A number of people said to me, these temples are basically all about selfishness. There's no spirituality really there at all. You just go there to get the god on your side to protect you against harm or to give you good fortune. So these spirits and these polytheistic deities they worship are just finite entities. And I thought later, you know, with this conception of God, it's no wonder they wonder, where did God come from? They don't have any conception of a transcendent, timeless, spaceless creator of the universe who is necessary in his existence. So it was against that background, I think, that this question kind of made sense again. So that was just a little flavor of the kind of interaction that we had during these sessions. Well, the next university that I spoke at after the Polytechnic was Hong Kong University. And there they booked an auditorium for the crowd because they were expecting a bigger crowd for that. And in fact, they had over twice as many students show up for this as they were expecting. And this set the pattern for the rest of the trip at these universities. In every case, the organizers were just shocked when twice as many students showed up at these talks than they were expecting to have. It just showed the kind of, again, interest and hunger that there was out there to hear messages on this kind of thing. So I talked on the subject, Five Reasons God Exists and Three Reasons It Makes a Difference. Some of you have heard that talk. And again, we had great interaction afterwards, including some interaction with one of the professors at the university who came and raised an objection, and I was able to answer that. So that was a good time. Then after Hong Kong University, I went to a university called the Chinese University, which is a sort of consortium of several colleges, kind of like Oxford and Cambridge is. And this was the best meeting yet. We had over 200 students come to the meeting. I spoke on the problem of suffering and evil. And again, the interaction was just so personal and so sincere. And students would come up to me afterwards and say, I'm not yet a Christian. I come from a Buddhist background, but this is what I'm thinking of, and can you help me? And then we would talk, and I stayed for a long time afterwards, just chatting one-on-one with students and trying to meet their needs. And then the local Christian group would be able to follow up these students afterwards. And that meeting at Chinese University just put me on a high, because it was so interactive, and it was so personal in touching these students with a real question they were dealing with. Well, after the Chinese University, the next one we went to was the University of Science and Technology, which is out in a part of Hong Kong on the mainland called the New Territories. It's out on the north coast, and it was just breathtakingly beautiful, this campus. It was looking out over the islands and the craggy shore of Hong Kong out into the Pacific Ocean. It was just beautiful. And I spoke there on how do all roads lead to God? And this talk, I mean, is really in your face, because what's implied in this talk in saying Christ is the only way of salvation is that their ancestors have gone to hell, at least a lot of them have. And ancestors are revered in China, even almost worshipped. And so this is a question that Chinese feel very deeply about. This question about pluralism and how can you say Christ is the only way. And what was neat about the Science and Technology University is that there were so many students there from mainland China, from communist China, studying, that the lecture was translated simultaneously, not into Cantonese, which is what they speak in Hong Kong, but into Mandarin, which is the language of the mainland. And then they did also have a Cantonese translation over headphones for any students in the audience who didn't speak Mandarin but wanted to hear the Cantonese lecture. They could get that with headphones. And this was, again, this was even better than the Chinese university. It was so exciting to see the students interact with me about Christianity. And these students from the mainland, you could tell, had almost no familiarity with Christianity because they come from communist China. And so the questions they were asking weren't about my talk. They were asking just basic questions they had about the Bible and God and Christ and things of this sort. And again, after that meeting, after the Q&A was over, I stayed for another hour or so just sitting in the aisles of this auditorium, just talking with this big group of students around me that were just bombarding me with questions. It was a wonderful time of doing evangelism, I think, with folks who had scarcely any familiarity with the gospel at all, which was really exciting. And then after the University of Science and Technology, I spoke again at Hong Kong Baptist University. The undergrad at Hong Kong Baptist University is sadly no longer a Christian university. Although it has the name Baptist, that was its origin. It's now a public state university. And so really a secular university, though there is a Christian presence still on the faculty there. And I spoke again, I think, that night on the problem of evil. This was a question that I was invited to speak on about three times. And I said, wouldn't you like more topics? And they said, no, this is a question we want to talk about. This was one that really, I guess, they felt deeply. So again, we had a great attendance at that meeting, a real big crowd, and good interaction after that. Well, the last and final university that I spoke at was, for me, the real highlight of the trip. This was the most exciting of all. We took the train and went through the border into mainland China, into Guangdong province, which is the communist part of China that borders on Hong Kong. And we went to the city of Guangzhou, or in English this is called Canton. This is a city twice as big as Hong Kong, something like 13.5 million people in Guangzhou. And it was also twice as polluted as Hong Kong. Hong Kong, the air was polluted, but in Guangzhou, the air was so thick with pollution, you could, the buildings were even obscured. Just a kind of milky haze just filled the air. And the Pearl River, which goes through the city, we were told, is just a stream of industrial waste. So it was really polluted, but it was a beautiful city nonetheless. The buildings are beautiful, and the area is beautiful. If China, as I said to Jan, ever someday passes Clean Air Act, it's going to be a beautiful country. But as it is now, it's sad to see how thick with pollution everything is. But we went to the university, which is named after Sun Yat-sen, the founder of modern China. You may have studied about him in your history class in junior high school or high school. But in Chinese, I guess his name is Zhongshan, and this was named Zhongshan University. And I was there not at the invitation of a campus Christian group, as I was in Hong Kong, but there they had arranged things so that I was there at the invitation of the university as a guest of the philosophy department. So the philosophy department met us there, took us to the university, beautiful campus, very spacious, tree-lined walkways, palm trees growing. It reminded me of Savannah. It really looked like Savannah, except that what looked like Spanish moss dripping from the trees was actually roots from the banyan trees that were all coming down. And it was just a gorgeous campus. And they had arranged for me to speak in an afternoon seminar to the philosophy department after lunch. Well, over lunch, I sat next to a Chinese philosopher in the department, and he confided to me in a whisper. He says, we have 40 men in the department, but he said, only half of them are real philosophers. And I knew what he meant from my experience in Soviet Russia, The philosophy departments in these communist countries are the departments where the Marxist indoctrinators are ensconced. And that's what philosophy has been in these communist countries. It was just teaching Marxist propaganda. And so about half the department were still these old line Marxists, and then the younger faculty were more bona fide thinkers who would study real philosophy. Well, during the seminar, I spoke on science and religion, friend or foe. And I gave six ways in which science and religion are friends and can interact together to help us discover the truth. And there were two of these old line Marxists in the audience. You could just tell because they were older, they were kind of grizzled, and they just went after me in the Q&A time. And they got very exercised. They were wagging their finger like this. I mean, you know, jabbering in Chinese just a mile a minute, scolding me almost like a child. But when they would translate this, you know, then for me into English to respond to, they really had no substantive objections at all. They were just venting their emotions that they didn't like this idea of science and religion getting together. And so I would try to respond in a very gracious and calm way. And I think it just made these fellows, as they ranted and raved, just look more and more isolated and more kind of behind the curve, if you know what I mean. It was very clear, I think, that where the real excitement is, where the real cutting edge is on the integration of science and faith, and that's where you needed to be doing your serious thinking. So it was a wonderful opportunity to be a Christian witness to the intellectual credibility of the Christian faith in the midst of this communist department and faculty. Well, that evening then, after supper, they had a public lecture scheduled that would be open to all the students. But they didn't hardly publicize this thing. They just put up a few handwritten posters that very day. But nevertheless, when we got to the room that night, it was packed with just wall-to-wall students. They were just squeezed into this. And then they were out the door. They fortunately had amplification. So students remained outside and listened to it over the loudspeaker, even though they couldn't get a place in the room. And I spoke on Can We Be Good Without God? And argued basically the moral argument that apart from God, there are no objective values, no duties, no moral accountability. And so if you do believe in those things, you have to believe in God as a basis for those. Well, you can imagine the kind of questions this provoked from an audience that's been schooled in atheism. And the questions were, many of them were written on paper, and they just keep pouring forward through the audience and piling up in front of us. Others were students standing up. But the questions weren't hostile. They weren't hostile questions. They were searching questions, wanting to know the answer, trying to understand what was being said. And so I put up on the whiteboard behind me, I put the premises of the argument up, and then I symbolized it in logical notation, explained the logic of it so they could understand it. And you could tell they were just really getting this. And my translator, Fee Sing, who is a professor at Hong Kong Baptist University, just did a crackerjack job of translating. He was so on top of it. I was told he was accurate just on every word. And he did it with intonation and emphasis. It was just terrific. And during the Q&A time, one student finally asked me right out, "Are you a Christian? And what makes Christianity superior to other world religions?" And I thought, well, this is my chance to share my testimony. You know, what we've been emphasizing in this class, you know, for weeks and weeks. And so I shared my testimony about how I came to Christ. And when I got to the part about how I cried out to God and I felt this infusion of joy as God came into my life and I ran outside, looked up at the stars and thought, I've come to know God. At that point, the whole student audience burst into applause spontaneously. And I then wound up my testimony by explaining why I thought Christianity was the truth and then encouraged them to do what I did if they were not yet a Christian, to pick up a New Testament. Oh, and at that point, I saw a girl sitting about two rows back in the audience, Chinese girl, smiling from ear to ear, and she held up like this her New Testament. You know, not so others could see it, but just enough for me to see it. She had her New Testament with her. And I said, pick up a New Testament, ask yourself, could there really be a God who exists, who loves you, who sent his son to die on the cross for you. It could change your life just as it changed mine. And at that point, they all burst into applause again. And the philosophy faculty who were there were just stunned by this. They had no anticipation that this many students would come. They had no idea there was this kind of interest. And they were especially shocked. They said, they all applauded when you shared your story. And I said, yeah, they did. And afterwards, the philosophers said to me, anytime you would like to come back to Zhongshan University again, you are welcome. And so it was really just an open door to further ministry there. And we were accompanied on that trip by about 14 of the Christians from Hong Kong who were kind of scouting it out to see what ministry opportunities there might be there for them to come back and try to build a movement on the campus. So it was just a really great time. There were many, many other things that we said and did and saw that I don't have time to describe, but those were just some of the highlights. And I felt like especially that trip to Zhongshan University in Guangzhou was really frontier evangelism. It was missions frontier because these were kids from parts of China where the gospel isn't freely proclaimed. I thought afterwards, you know, no missionary could have done what happened at this meeting because it's illegal. But I was there as a guest of the university, as an academic lecturer, and I get in, the door is open, and I share my testimony, you know? So it's just exciting. Yeah, amen. It's exciting again to see how God can use Christian academics in settings that would be closed to your traditional missionaries. And they're talking now about maybe doing a tour of various Chinese universities in the mainland where I would be able to give these kinds of academic talks. I mean, they're really apologetics talks, but to them, academic talks, then followed by Q&A. And they said that when I called for the students to, you know, pick up a New Testament and make a commitment to Christ, that I really kind of stepped over the line. They said, you shouldn't have done that. I mean, that's what my Hong Kong friends said, not the philosophers, the Hong Kong folks said, because they said, you know, this isn't supposed to happen, these kind of things. But they said, if there are any ripples, any problems, we'll just say there was a student who asked you straight out the question and you were merely responding to the question. And they said, we don't think there'll be any trouble. But it did remind me, you have to mind your P's and Q's. There are, you know, there are limits. Well, any questions or reactions you might have? Yes. Certainly at the universities in Hong Kong, there's follow-up because I was there at the invitation of the InterVarsity and Campus Crusade groups and the Christian Scholars Faculty Fellowship, so they will certainly be there. But at Guangzhou, there's nothing that I know of, and I don't think that they knew of formally to follow up students there, except these informal contacts. And certainly these Hong Kong folks want to go back there again, as I say. They want to see something happen there. And I expect there were some emails and business cards that were exchanged. That's very traditional in China. So only those informal contacts. But given the situation, that's about the best you can do. Clearly, there were some Christians there, like the girl who held up the New Testament. So this, I mean, undoubtedly, you can imagine the encouragement this was to her faith. And she'll probably be witnessing to her friends, hopefully. And so that's the kind of thing where you just have to trust the Lord. There isn't anything organized that I know of. Yes. Yeah. That's right. Where I planted, Apollos watered, but God gives the growth. And so Paul says, neither Apollos counts for anything, nor Paul for anything, but only God who gives the growth. I was just reading that verse in 1 Corinthians 3. Because, you see, at Moody yesterday, I had to follow Ravi Zacharias on the program. And I thought, you know, I'm not here to compete with Ravi. We're here to help train these Christians. And Apollos and Paul are just stewards, like you say, of the grace of God. It's God who gives the growth. And so I was just doing an attitude check, you know, using that verse, you know, and following him, because that can be intimidating. Yeah, the Bibles, we were told that Bibles are accessible there, that's not a problem. But doing this kind of evangelism is something that can't happen publicly. Yes, I can actually. It's really very odd. There's a Christian physicist at Hong Kong University named Chris Beeling, and he was wanting to teach in some of his classes about intelligent design, which is this kind of new movement in biology that Christians are spearheading to argue against the Darwinian mechanisms of evolution by saying you need an intelligent designer. But Hong Kong University clamped down on him and said you may not teach these things, and they prohibited him from teaching a couple of these courses. Well, he was so frustrated by this, he said, we need to bring in some kind of an outside speaker who could address these issues and put them on the table so they'll be discussed. And so he wrote to me and said, would you be willing to come to Hong Kong? And I said, yeah, I'd be delighted to. And I think he said later that kind of caught him by surprise, because now all of a sudden he found himself in charge of this speaking tour that he knew nothing about. And so I suggested he contact other groups in Hong Kong, and immediately he got in touch with InterVarsity, Campus Crusade, other Christian academics. There was one gal there named Pauline Chu, who's a Christian chemist at Hong Kong University. She'd studied at the University of Toronto and spoke flawless English. And she really helped to mastermind and plan this trip, along with just a number of other people in these churches that I mentioned at which I spoke. And so it was really a coalition of these various groups just cobbling this thing all together. And then under Pauline and Chris's supervision, and with Bob and Mary's tremendous help as a catalyst in helping them to organize it, it all came together beautifully. And it turned out to be a beautifully organized trip. Yeah. Scotty asked if there was any kind of protest or anything of that sort. Nothing like that. You know, and this is funny, I find this in the United States too. I never seem to get hostile people. Now there'll be skeptical questioners, but never anybody that's really threatening or hostile in that way. And I guess I think if you just approach these questions with sweet reason, people respond in that way. So, it wasn't like that at all. The audiences were very sincere. You could tell from their questions they weren't hostile. They really wanted to know the truth and were interested in what I had to share. Okay, anybody else? Yeah, David. That was done through a philosophy professor named Kai Man Kwan, whom Jan and I had met years ago at a conference in Beijing. He is a Christian philosopher, good brother. And Kaiman had some kind of connections with the philosophers at Zhongshan University. And so Kaiman, I guess, contacted them and says, we're having this Christian philosopher from the United States speaking at our university here in Hong Kong. Would you like to have him there? And apparently they said, yeah, that sounds great. So it was again, through this network of fellow Christian philosophers. And I just love these guys. Fi Sing and Kai Man, just such dear Christian brothers, committed to Christ and also committed to doing first-rate Christian scholarship in their fields of theology and philosophy, respectively. Just great guys. And they both translated for me. And so they knew all the vocabulary and the concepts and were able to just do a masterful job. But it was through him that it was set up. Yes, Sydney. You know, the only thing, it's hard to know. I mean, we really had to deal a lot with just physical illness and exhaustion while we were there. Poor Jan had a head bursting with sinusitis when we went. And I then, after I was there, also fell ill. But we had these antibiotics with us that we had brought with us from Atlanta. And that really saved the day. Plus, I could tell after speaking three times about the second day. I spoke three times in a row, and the last time without amplification, which was a mistake. And I could tell afterwards, I'm losing my voice. I'm going hoarse. If I give the talk tonight, I'm going to have total laryngitis. And so what I arranged for Pauline Chu to do was she actually gave my talk that night. I have my talks all written out word for word. So Pauline took the text, she gave the talk, and she did a great job. I mean, she had emphasis and intonation and everything. I thought, this is a good way to give talks. I just sit back and, you know, have her give it. And then I answered the questions during the Q&A. And that saved my voice. and saved the trip, really. It saved the rest of the trip. So there was that element. But you know, when we went into these Buddhist temples and these Taoist temples, I was a little leery, frankly, because I thought, could these be inhabited with demonic beings? You know, could there be, might we in some way infect or oppress ourselves by entering these things? But I have to say, I didn't sense that at all. When I went into these places, they were like commercial enterprises. You know what the centerpiece of these temples is? It's fortune telling. People go in there and they throw these pieces of wood and then tell you whether or not you're going to have good luck or bad luck. And it was really a commercial enterprise. People weren't in there for spiritual reasons in the sense of to meet with God or anything. It was so unspiritual. It was so crass and commercialized and mechanical that I didn't sense any kind of evil spirits there at all. Did you, honey? I mean, it was really depressing seeing these poor people going through these mechanical, meaningless prayers and things. But so we had the illness to deal with, but nothing, you know, apart from that. I think the trip was really bathed in prayer on both sides of the Pacific, and so we felt, I think, very comfortable being there. One aspect of the trip that I forgot to mention, and I wish I had brought this with me this morning to show you, but in preparation for my being there, they translated four of my articles into Chinese. The one on contemporary scholarship and the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, the five arguments God exists and three reasons it makes a difference, article on the necessity of theological foundations for morality, and then the one called The Ultimate Questions of Origins on the Big Bang and how it points to God. And these were then put into four separate little booklets that were then put into a boxed set that they would sell and make available to students. And the graphics on these were so slick. They were just beautifully done, very polished little booklets in this boxed set. And it was a wonderful tool for folks to follow up and to learn more about what was said, and it was something they could take with them. And that was, I think, one of the sharpest things that they did for this trip, was having these translated materials. Yes, George? Well, I would say obliquely, not directly. I never mentioned Marxism. I never even mentioned, I don't think, the word atheism. But what I would say would be things like, if God does not exist, there is no sound foundation for morality, because without God, there are no objective values and are no objective moral duties. There's no moral accountability. And then I would argue that there are those things, and therefore you need to believe in God. Well, implicitly, yeah, that denies atheism and denies Marxism. But I didn't say things like Marx was wrong or dialectical materialism is wrong. But, I mean, it was shot through everything I said about science and religion and about moral values. So they, you know, there's this veneer of Marxism to which lip service is given. But I don't think a lot of these philosophers even believe it themselves. We were very careful not to ask them about any of their beliefs, because you don't want to out them, you know, and endanger them. But we suspected, for example, that one of these philosophers may have well been a Christian secretly, because he was so enthusiastic and warm and welcoming. We just had a feeling that he knew the Lord. But, you know, we didn't try to out him in any way. Yes? Well, not from the trip per se, but from things that we read in preparation for going there, it's pretty bad in China right now, unfortunately. The government is really cracking down on the house churches and imprisoning its leaders. It's ugly. I mean, it really is a hideous kind of government and system that exists there. And you just kind of have to, as I say, go below the radar a little bit and not try to overtly stand up and make an issue of it. And then you'll be all right, at least if you're there as I was. You see, as a guest of the university, I was officially there. I wasn't doing anything wrong. So we were safe in that sense. But Yeah, the persecution is ongoing right now and even accelerated in recent years. Well, there's been a change of government, and the new guy is cracking down. He's tightening the reins even more. There's another cult in China called Falun Gong, which is a, I don't know, mystical cult, and the Chinese government is committed to eradicating it. And these people have been brutally persecuted. We saw posters in Hong Kong protesting the persecution of Falun Gong, and they had pictures of people, you know, with bloodied feet that had just been beaten until their feet were raw and bruises all over their legs and bodies. It was really horrible what's happening in China to these people. And I mean, even though they're a cult, nevertheless, they have a right to religious freedom and belief, we think, but not in China. So it's pretty sad. Yeah, that's the hope, is that as they become more and more a capitalistic economy, and boy, you could see that there, that this free enterprise would bring more political and religious freedom. But up to this point, at least, they're able to do this balancing act of having a kind of free enterprise capitalist economy, but have no political or religious freedom at the same time. And the horror would be a China that becomes vastly wealthy, capitalistically speaking, but continues to have a communist government. That would be really scary. Pardon me?
It's a contradiction.
Yeah, and the question is whether or not they can do it. I mean, that's what they're determined to do, and that would be horrible. I mean, you could see that leading to a world war someday. So the hope is that as in Russia, that this government will eventually have to change too, and that will be a glorious day. Well, again, thanks so much for your prayers and all the support that you lent to us. It was an exhausting but really a very rich and rewarding time, and we were glad to be there as representatives from JFBC and from this class as well. Well, we've got a little time left, so maybe we can have a word of prayer, and then we'll say something about our lesson today. Father, we do thank you so much that we are ambassadors for Christ, you making your appeal through us. And Lord, we would pray that you would help each of us to be cognizant of the opportunities that you bring our way. Help us to be bold and fearless witnesses for you in our workplace and in our families and with friends, wherever you would give us the opportunity to bear word for Christ. And now we commit this time to you, Lord, and pray that through what time we have to get into the lesson, that you would begin again to disciple our minds through what we study. In Jesus' name, amen. Let me just say again, before I get into the lesson, that now that we're back on the regular curriculum again, I want to encourage you to use these little cards to invite folks to the class and to tell folks we're getting back into the swing of things with the doctrine and apologetics. And so if they've been out of it for a while because they've been doing another 40 Days of Purpose class or something, invite them to rejoin us again. Well, we've been looking at arguments for the existence of God. Marion wants me to point out that we have outlines today for you. So if you don't have an outline, raise your hand, and I think Marion will distribute them. We've been looking at arguments for the existence of God. And it occurred to me as we watched that Austin Dacey debate at Purdue University, and especially the one gal who said, after seeing his first speech, "Are you sure this doesn't do more harm than good?" That maybe what we ought to do is spend a little time looking at arguments against the existence of God, such as those that were raised by Austin Dacey, and seeing exactly where the weaknesses in those arguments lie, so that we'll have not only a positive case for belief in God, but we'll also have a defensive critique of the objections that are typically raised against God's existence. And so we want to begin by looking at what I call epistemological objections. Now, epistemology is a big word that you should learn that means theory of knowledge. Epistemology is the theory of knowledge, how we know things. It comes from the Greek word episteme, which means knowledge. And so these arguments are basically rooted in the impossibility of having a knowledge of God's existence, that somehow the evidence isn't enough, or that it isn't rational to believe in God. These are arguments based upon theism not meeting the requirements for knowledge. So that's why I call them epistemological objections, that somehow theism, or the belief that God exists, just doesn't measure up to what we call knowledge. Now, the first challenge that I want to think about with you is called verificationism. Verificationism was a philosophy that was dominant during the first half of the 20th century in the Anglo-American world. It belonged, well, so much for that one. Let me try this marker. It belonged to a school of thought. Well, okay. No, there's not. So I will just tell you the words, and Marion will have to figure out how to spell them as best she can. They belong to a school called logical positivism. And basically what logical positivism tried to say is that religious beliefs or other types of beliefs like this are unverifiable through the five senses, and therefore they're meaningless. Okay, here's a green one. Thanks, Bob. Let's see. Logical positivism said that religious beliefs are unverifiable through the five senses, and therefore they are meaningless. And they championed something called the verification principle of meaning. The verification principle of meaning. According to the verification principle of meaning, an informative sentence, in order to be meaningful, must be capable of being empirically verified. Let me repeat that. An informative sentence, in order to be meaningful, must be capable of being empirically verified. That is to say, you have to be able to verify it through your five senses. And if it cannot be empirically verified, then the statement isn't false. It's meaningless. It's neither true nor false. It's just a meaningless combination of words. Thank you, Marion. Whoops. Thank you. That's all right. So, since statements like God exists, or God loves me, or God sent his son into the world were, in the view of the verificationists, not capable of being verified through the five senses, they said that they're meaningless. It would be like saying, "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wave." You know, it's just meaningless. It's not false. It doesn't even have the dignity to be false. It's just meaningless. And this verification principle went through a number of revisions. One of them was called the falsification principle. And according to the falsification principle, a meaningful sentence must be capable, in principle, of being falsified. That is to say, there must be some empirical test that you could perform in principle that would show the statement to be false. And if there's nothing you could do to prove it was false, then the sentence was just meaningless. And the prospects for religious language under the falsification principle were no brighter than under the verification principle, because these thinkers believed that there is no conditions under which religious statements could be falsified or verified, because they were just totally non-empirical. That is to say, they were about entities that aren't discernible by the five senses, like God. God loves me. There's nothing you can do to empirically verify that or falsify it through your five senses. Any question about those two principles before I illustrate one of them? All right. So to give an example, there was a symposium held at Oxford University in 1948 called Theology and Falsification, which featured the famous British philosopher Anthony Flew. And Flew borrowed a story that he had heard from another philosopher to illustrate the falsification principle in operation against religious language. He said, let's imagine that there were two explorers working their way through the jungle. And they come upon a clearing in the jungle in which they find a patch of flowers growing. And the one explorer is convinced that this patch of flowers is in fact a garden that has been planted there by some gardener who tends it. And the other philosopher says, well, no, this is just a natural clearing in the jungle in which some flowers happen to grow. And so in the story that Flew tells, they try to find the gardener. They camp out near the clearing, but no gardener is ever seen. They set up electrical tripwires around the clearing, and no alarms ever go off. They're never able to find any trace of the gardener. And in order to save his hypothesis that there is a gardener, the one explorer has to continually revise his hypothesis by saying, well, maybe the gardener is an invisible gardener, or maybe he's intangible and so never trips the electrical fence. It's an undetectable gardener. And finally, in frustration, the other explorer replies, well, just how does what you call an invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener differ from no gardener at all? Well, the gardener in the story is obviously a symbol of God. And the idea here is that an intangible, undetectable, eternally elusive God is no different than no God at all. And so the story was meant to illustrate the meaninglessness of the God hypothesis, just as the gardener hypothesis was said to be meaningless. Now, as you think about this story, I think we would all agree that the gardener hypothesis had, in fact, suffered death by a thousand qualifications, as Flew put it. It had become so revised and contrived that it was no longer plausible. But why does that disqualify the gardener hypothesis? What was wrong with that? Well, I think the answer is that the gardener hypothesis becomes increasingly and increasingly contrived to fit the results. In other words, it becomes what is sometimes called ad hoc. Ad hoc is Latin meaning to this. And it means, in a sense, that the hypothesis becomes tailored to the facts. You see, it doesn't explain the facts. Just whatever the facts are, you just adjust the hypothesis to fit it. So it becomes increasingly ad hoc, and therefore is not a good explanation. To give an illustration in science, in the late 19th century, physicists believed that light was carried by an invisible medium called the ether, just as waves in the ocean are carried by water, or sound waves are carried by the air. So they thought light was waves in this invisible medium of the ether. But experimental attempt failed to detect any presence of the ether. And the concept of the ether got continually revised and revised. It was said, well, maybe the ether somehow binds to the earth and travels along the earth with it like an atmosphere, so that's why we can't detect our motion through the ether. Maybe the ether has certain intangible properties that prevent us from detecting it. And it finally got so contrived and revised that the ether became no different than nothing at all. It was just revised and contrived right out of existence. So the ether hypothesis became so ad hoc and contrived that it was abandoned by modern physics. Now, in exactly the same way, this gardener hypothesis is an unacceptable hypothesis because it becomes so artificially tailored to the facts and contrived that it becomes unacceptably ad hoc. But what Flew was arguing was that the gardener hypothesis was meaningless. And that's very different, you see. To say the hypothesis is unacceptable because it's contrived or ad hoc is not to say that it's meaningless. Flew seemed to think that the conditions for falsifying a hypothesis were part of the meaning of the hypothesis. The conditions for falsifying it were part of what the hypothesis meant. And so if there were no conditions that would falsify it, the hypothesis was literally meaningless. Well, that's obviously wrong, because the very fact that the two explorers were able to disagree on their hypothesis shows that they clearly understood each other. The problem with the Gardner hypothesis was not that it was meaningless. It was that it was false. It was ad hoc. But it was clearly meaningful because the explorers could argue about it, and they could set up tests to try to detect the Gardner. So they clearly understood it, and similarly, the God hypothesis is one we clearly understand. We understand what it means to say God loves me or God created the world. The question then is not whether those hypotheses are meaningless, but in this case, whether it's unacceptably ad hoc or not. So the Gardner story that he gave really failed to show, I think, that religious statements, if they're unverifiable or unfalsifiable, are meaningless. Now, is there any question or comment about that before I go further? Do you understand why this parable or story doesn't show it to be meaningless? Yes?
When did the convention take place in 48?
Oxford University. It was a symposium called Theology and Falsification. All right. Well, in general, the verification principle of meaning suffered two debilitating weaknesses. First of all, the principle was too restrictive. It was too restrictive a criterion of meaning. It was very quickly realized by epistemologists or theorists of knowledge that if you follow this principle, it would force you to regard as meaningless vast stretches of human discourse and language, including not just religious statements, but ethical statements, aesthetic statements, metaphysical statements, and in the end, even scientific statements. There are a lot of statements in science that are not verifiable or falsifiable in and of themselves, so that the principle would just be utterly unreasonable because it would be far too restrictive. We clearly have meaningful discourse in areas of human language which are not subject to either verification or falsification. But secondly, and this was the especially damning criticism, it turned out that the verification principle is self-refuting. It's self-refuting. For just to ask yourself the question, is this statement verifiable or falsifiable? A meaningful sentence must be verifiable. Is that verifiable? Well, no. There's no scientific test, no experiment you could perform to determine this, the truth of this. And therefore, the verification principle turns out by its own criterion to be just a meaningless combination of words. That sentence has no meaning by its own criterion. And therefore, there's no reason to be bothered by it, no reason to be troubled by it. Or at best, it would just be an arbitrary definition which we're at liberty to reject. And indeed, not a very good definition because, as I said in point one, it's evident that there are vast stretches of human language and discourse which are meaningful even though they're not verifiable or falsifiable. And therefore, by the second half of the 20th century, the verification principle had collapsed under the deficiencies of its own incoherence. It was self-refuting, self-referentially incoherent. It refuted itself, and therefore logical positivism and its verification principle collapsed. And what happened in the second half of the 20th century then is there has been a revival of metaphysics. Metaphysics is the area of philosophy that asks about the nature of ultimate reality and talks about issues that are beyond empirical verification, beyond your five senses. And with this renaissance of metaphysics has come as well a renaissance of philosophy of religion, and particularly Christian philosophy of religion. So in large measure, the contemporary burst of activity, this renaissance of interest in philosophy of religion, is due to the collapse of logical positivism and verificationism in the second half of the 20th century. Sadly, however, I find in speaking at universities, you will still hear people espousing this kind of verificationism, particularly people in the sciences who were educated, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, or students who were educated under those type of men and have never done any work in epistemology outside of that. And you need to help gently explain to these folks that they're just out of touch. They're completely out of date. And that for those two reasons that I just gave, this verificationist theory of meaning is just untenable. Yes, Cindy. Yeah. What that person is talking about, Cindy, is not science. What he's talking about is logical positivism. And that's what you need to help the person see. Say, you're not talking about science. You're talking about a philosophy of science called verificationism. And if you adopt this verificationist epistemology, you will destroy science, you can tell this person, because science itself has unverifiable statements in it. Let me just give you one, okay, if you need an example. In science, there's a principle called the Copernican principle, which says that we occupy no special place in the universe. That is to say, that the laws of nature that we observe governing Earth are the same laws of nature that govern Andromeda and the distant galaxies that we see. But there's no way to prove that. There's no way to prove that there's not a wholly different set of laws of nature that govern the other galaxies. We simply have to assume in science, in order to do science, that the same laws of nature that obtain here obtain there. And that's called the Copernican principle. It's a foundational assumption of science. It cannot be proved scientifically. So if you only believe in things that are empirically verifiable, you have to reject the Copernican principle and you completely destroy science. And as I say, this is not a Christian critique. This principle in positivism succumbed under the criticism of secular philosophers of science who realized that this theory of meaning was too restrictive. And then, as well, you point out to your friend the other point was that there are truths that are not accessible by science, like ethical truths and aesthetic truths and truths about the nature of the world, like, for example, that there is an external world. Remember, I gave examples earlier that you cannot prove scientifically that you're not a brain in a vat of chemicals being stimulated by electrodes.
You know, using the five senses, yes, I can, for me, because I can see myself, I can touch myself. I'm using my five senses to verify that I'm, in fact, here.
Well, but see, that wouldn't work, Cindy, if on a strict verificationist view, because if you were a brain in a vat of chemicals, you would have exactly those same sensations. You're feeling yourself is nothing but the sensation of your nerve endings in your brain. You don't have to actually have a body to have the feeling that you're touching a body. All you have to do is have those nerve sensations. And if you're wired up with electrodes in a vat of chemicals, you know, your brain is, he can make you feel your body, see these other people, hear them, you know, all of that. So, again, I'm not trying to make you a skeptic, but what I'm trying to say is that if you adopt the epistemology that you only believe what can be empirically verified, you won't believe in those kind of metaphysical truths like there is an external world, which is crazy. So you show the person that it's too restrictive, and then you also show them that it would undermine itself. Okay, I'll take one more question, and then I have to let you go because we're over time. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. I'm so glad you brought that illustration up. I had forgotten about that, but the movie Contact, I think, is a brilliant critique of verificationism. And especially what I like is when she has that vision of the cosmos and she cries, "I never knew, I never knew." And it's like a person when he first comes to know Christ, first comes to know God. And you go back and you try to tell people, it's real. You know, God is real. He's there. And they say, show me the evidence. You'll prove it. And you're at a loss for words. And yet you've experienced that self-authenticating presence of the divine in the same way she did in the movie. And I thought that was a beautiful illustration of just the inadequacies of this kind of verificationism. So that's a good cultural bridge. If you can talk to someone, say, hey, did you see the movie Contact? It's just like that. I think that's very helpful. All right. Well, next time we'll come back and look at the presumption of atheism. And I hope to show that indeed atheism is very presumptuous and that we have no reason to presume it's true.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.